This is Law and Disorder.
This week on Law and Disorder, we'll have a rare conversation with a family member of a Guantanamo Bay detainee.
Tasif Paracha has an uncle in Guantanamo and a cousin here at MCC, the jail in New York.
Paul Chevenier, longtime lawyer on the case, will tell us about the police claim to unrestricted photo surveillance of demonstrators and the challenge that we're facing in court.
We thought we had won this one. We thought we'd stop the cops from photographing us at demos. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Good morning. This is Jeff Brady, producer of Law and Disorder. And I have joining me on the line is Michael Ratner, co-host of Law and Disorder and president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we are set up this way because of the transit strike, holiday vacations and such. But we want to bring this update to listeners, an update on the Padilla case, an update on the president admitting to an impeachable offense of surveilling U.S. citizens. Michael, what can you tell listeners about the recent situation regarding the Padilla case?
Well, the Padilla case, as people may recall, was the so-called dirty bomber who came into the United States, got off a plane in Chicago, and then was arrested by the United States, or rather detained, and put into a military brig. He was in a military brig for 3.5 years. His case went up and down through the courts for a while, and the question in his case was whether he could be held without trial and without charges and as an enemy combatant simply under the authority of the president. We don't accept this. You came into this court and cried about how this guy's an enemy combatant, dangerous, dangerous, dangerous. And now as the Supreme Court wants to review, probably the court said one of the most important issues in the country, the authority to hold U.S. citizens arrested domestically as enemy combatants. You want to remove jurisdiction from the court. We're not going along with you. We think this puts into question your entire rationale of enemy combatants and the war on terror, and we don't think this is sufficient, and you haven't explained why you have done this and why this man has been in jail 3.5 years.
Right. For the Fourth Circuit to question this like they did.
A conservative circuit to say, government, what are you doing here, Bush administration? You're playing fast and loose with the courts. We don't like it. You're playing fast and loose with Mr. Padilla's freedom. We don't like it. We will leave it up to the Supreme Court to decide what to do, but you're not going to get us to go along with this plan. So it's another really amazing ruling by a court, and particularly remarkable because the key judge on the court is very conservative, and for him to come out like this means the courts are really furious at the utter lawlessness of this administration. It's really what we've been saying for a long time, that the idea that you can simply hold people as enemy combatants and not take them through a court and not allow them to really test their detention really puts in jeopardy everyone's freedom. It allows the Bush administration to simply remove people from public life, from the streets, from anywhere in the world, throw them in brigs, and then when it's convenient for them, a few years later, we might try them, we might not, we might keep them in jail forever. So it really goes to the heart of what this administration is doing.
This is a very important update in the Padilla case. And Law and Disorder has been following this case for the past year and a half. You can go to lawanddisorder.org and toward the top of the page, you'll see past shows, and you can click on that and do a search on our past shows page for Padilla and listen to those shows.
You know, Jeff, it's related. It's interesting to me. It's related to the next issue that we really want to talk about, which is the passage of an amendment in Congress. As we speak, it hasn't been signed, but it will be signed, called the Graham-Leven Amendment. And the Graham-Leven Amendment was passed on December 21st in the late evening. And that's the amendment that really has concerned the Center for Constitutional Rights and me in particular, because that's the one that strips the courts of the right to hear cases coming out of Guantanamo. And it's, again, related to Padilla, because here we have the Congress now with Graham, who's, of course, Republican, but Levin, who's supposedly a liberal Democrat from Michigan, getting behind legislation that is an attempt to wipe out the Center for Constitutional Rights' Supreme Court victory in the Guantanamo cases. What we won in those cases in June 2004, in a case called Razul, what we won, it's called habeas corpus, which means the right to find out why you've been detained by a government. What we won in the Supreme Court was the right to go to court and challenge the detentions of the people at Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. The administration has not liked this. They, again, don't want to be interfered with by the courts. They don't want the courts telling them that they have to stay within the law. What the Congress approved last week, the Graham-Leven Amendment, will strip the Supreme Court of a case that's pending there right now, one that challenges the Guantanamo detentions and military commissions. It will attempt to strip the circuit court of a case we have there now, claiming that there's due process rights. We will, of course, argue that it can't do that, that it's illegal to do that. It only is prospective toward the future, that you can't strip out the right of habeas corpus from the Constitution and from our clients. But this is how bad it's gotten out there, that they didn't like a court decision, 6-3 in the Supreme Court, and they now got a bunch of liberal senators to go along with it. It's utterly a complete outrage.
I agree. This is kind of depressing. But we know that the administration is starting to unravel at the same time.
A lot of the Democrats are folding up, and Levin was one of them. Mm. You have others, of course, out there like Conyers, who's now suggesting impeachment and issued a long report saying, look, I think there's impeachable offenses here, both concerning the war in Iraq and the lying, as well as the National Security Agency warrantless spying. But you have others like this so-called Senator Levin saying, well, it's going to be okay to use evidence from torture and okay to strip the Supreme Court of jurisdiction. Levin's theories here, Graham Levin, may not work because, as you can see, even in the Padilla case, there's been such anger over the stripping of the Supreme Court, the attempt to take Padilla out from under the court, that conceivably this effort by Graham and Levin and what I can only call our spineless Democrats will fail, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Is it a certainty that the habeas law will not be useful for attorneys representing Guantanamo detainees or any detainees?
It's an attempt to do it, Jeff. I'm not clear that they're going to succeed. I mean, we're claiming that it won't have any application to our clients. It only goes to the future. We claim that it's unconstitutional. But in fact, what it purports to do is strip habeas corpus from the courts and allow evidence of torture.
Michael, on the surveillance story, how did this story break?
The way this story emerged was a story in the New York Times. The Times, amazingly, has held the story for 1 year. In my view, it just tells you about journalism in this country.
So, Michael, this was suspected all along, this surveilling, illegal surveillance by many critics. Now we've got confirmation. I understand that Bush brought the two New York Times reporters into the White House to talk to them about the story.
I mean, it's amazing. What he said to them is, you reveal this story, and it'll hurt our national security and alert the terrorists. I mean, this is like, as if terrorists out there or alleged terrorists don't know their conversations are being wiretapped. They assume there's a foreign surveillance court. They assume they're being wiretapped. I mean, it's absurd. It just makes no sense at all. Because he could have gone to the Foreign Surveillance Court and gotten these wiretaps, but he didn't. He went outside the court. And he went outside the court purposely because they want to enhance presidential authority, what you would have to call, and a friend of mine recently did, what we call the Fuhrer's Law. Whatever the Fuhrer says is the law. That's what they're trying to do here. They tried to do that in the torture area. Now they're doing it in the wiretap area. So that's what we're really talking about. But it came out in the Times a year later. And the Times, as I said, held it up because so-called concerns that the White House gave it on national security. And then they revealed it just this December. Now, why did they reveal it all of a sudden? Well, was it because they felt the administration is on the run, that it's weak, that they had a journalistic obligation to do so? I don't think any of those are the reasons. The man who wrote, he's co-authored the article, I believe, is coming out with a book on this issue in January. So at that point, the guy puts out a book, the Times is going to be scooped on the story. Therefore, they had to come out with a story. So they came out with it. So it's not like they were, you know, great. They were great journalists for getting the story, but not for holding it up. And it reminds you of a couple of other instances. Recently, the Times had a story about secret detention facilities that the CIA was running, so-called black sites all over the world. Two of them were in Europe. The Times refused to print the names of the two sites and the two countries where they were, which were Romania and Poland. The next day, of course, Human Rights Watch gave out the names. But the Times, again, shirking its obligation as journalists, refused to do it. And again, it reminds you of what happened at the Abu Ghraib photos. CBS had those photos for a number of weeks. They didn't put those photos out in April of 2004. They only put them out when the New Yorker was going to run a story about it, and then they felt they were going to be scooped. So you're seeing really weak-kneed journalists out there, weak-kneed newspapers in particular, that really could be, they're doing us all a major disservice. Anyway, that's how that came out.
We've seen a complicit mainstream media delaying big stories that would have major political impacts.
The NSA story, of course, is about warrantless wiretapping. And what's remarkable about the story is the president, after 9/11, went to the Congress through the Patriot Act and said, I need more authority to wiretap, and I need it to even go after American citizens if they're alleged terrorists. And I want to be able to do that, and I also want to be able to use any evidence from these so-called intelligence wiretaps in criminal court. The Congress gave him the authority he wanted. Despite that authority, the president decided that wasn't enough, or decided he didn't want to, or really decided he wanted to enhance presidential powers, and bypassed the court in literally what apparently was, at any one moment, 500-some people being surveilled right now as we speak, and who knows how many tens of thousands of conversations being picked up without a warrant. So here the president goes to the Congress, gets the authority he wants, and then refuses to comply with it and goes outside of that authority. But at this point, he's clearly violated the law. He should have gone to Congress, and he should obviously be impeached.
This is could be a big one that may take the administration down.
Well, there's been a lot of big ones, but this is the clearest-cut one in which there's been an absolute admission that he violated the law. He didn't use those words, I violated the law, but he gave us the facts by which it's very clear he violated fundamental rights, the Fourth Amendment, but as well as the criminal law in the United States. And there's a lot of anger in Congress, whether real or feigned, about what he's done. And it's a hard one to justify. Because even if you buy into the claim, you need this authority to track down terrorism in the United States, why didn't he go to the secret court, which last year, Jeff, out of some 1,700 requests for approval of wiretaps, did not turn down one of those requests. So he has no excuse. I mean, the excuse that terrorism justifies this doesn't make any sense. What he's really saying is that I don't want to be bound by the Constitution and the checks and balances that set up this republic.
Well, Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and co-host of Law and Disorder, thank you very much for these updates and have a wonderful holiday.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
For a year and a half now, we on Law and Disorder have been talking about the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Today, to add another angle to our ongoing discussion, we have with us Tosif Paracha, who has an uncle at Guantanamo Bay. Tosif, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Tosif, why don't you start a little bit by talking about your uncle's case in Guantanamo. Who is he? How long has he been there? What's his situation?
My uncle's name is Saifullah Paracha. He was basically kidnapped. He was on a trip from Karachi to Bangkok in July of 2003. We didn't know where he was for 2 months, and then received a letter from the Red Cross saying that he's being held in Bagram.
What did you think?
We didn't know what was going on. We basically, for 2 months, we were out of the blue. My aunt, my uncle's wife, was extremely worried. It's just like kidnapping. You know, someone takes your relative away and you have no idea where he is. And then, you know, you receive a letter that he's being held in Bagram. And then in October of 2004, he was moved to Guantanamo. Ever since then, he's been there.
Have you gotten letters from him?
Yeah, we get letters sporadically, you know, every 2-3 months we get a letter from him.
They're censored, as I understand.
Yeah,
right?
They're very censored.
Do you have any idea why he was taken? I mean, he was on a business trip. What does he do, and why do you think the U.S. government was interested in him?
He was, basically this all started in March of 2003. His son, Uzair Paracha, was detained here in the U.S. And 6 months later, basically my uncle was kidnapped. Uzair Paracha's case dealt with a man by the name of Majid Khan. Majid Khan, what Uzair Paracha did was, supposedly he met Majid Khan in Pakistan, and Majid Khan said, "When you do me a favor, when you get to America, just make a phone call for me and then call the INS." So what Uzair did, he called the INS to find out this person's immigration status. And what happened in March of 2003, he was arrested. You know, the government said, "Why are you finding out about this person? This person's a member of Al-Qaeda." Uzair Paracha said, "I had no idea. You know, my father just told me to find out. He was a friend of a friend." So ever since then, this case has been going on. And then in July of 2003, my uncle was kidnapped. So this is all related. Uzair's trial just happened here in New York in November.
So now we have, to lay it out, we have your cousin here who made the phone call to INS.
To INS, yeah.
And then your uncle who's sitting in Guantanamo at this point, right?
Presumably, yep. Because he asked
his son to make a phone call,
and I assume it's a material support provision saying that calling to inquire about this man's immigration status was akin to offering material support to a terrorist.
Yeah, but the key fact of the case is that Majid Khan, you know, wherever he's held, and see, a big part of this case was we were trying to get Majid Khan to be a witness. Because, you know, that's Uzair's right as
yes. And he is the person that the government is accusing of being the Al-Qaeda.
Exactly. But yeah. what we got was we got a deposition from Majid Khan. And Majid Khan specifically said that Uzair Paracha did not know that I was Al-Qaeda. He had no idea. He has this sworn testimony that says this.
So what happened?
This is the trial we're talking about now here in New York, right?
Here in New
York.
Your cousin
2 weeks or a few weeks ago was tried in New York.
Yeah.
For making this phone call and supposedly giving material support. And you had an affidavit in that case from
Majid Khan,
who is in U.S. custody somewhere in the world, right? Conceivably a black site.
A black site, yeah.
Right, where we don't know where he is. And he put in an affidavit, "This guy didn't know anything about me," right?
Didn't know. He said the father, Saifullah Paracha and Uzair Paracha, did not know anything about me. They didn't even know my real name. You know, they had no idea I was a part of Al-Qaeda. You know, there's sworn testimony that says this.
And what happened at the trial?
At the trial, what happened was, you know, the government played a really dirty game. You know, you can't get a fair trial here. You have people here. If you look outside the courtroom, you see ground zero. You know, what happened with the prosecutors, they kept on scaring the jury members. So, you know, he ended up getting convicted. But, you know, we're definitely going to appeal.
They talked about Osama, did they, in the trial?
They talked about Osama. They talked about all these things.
See, they bring in pictures of anything like that?
No, they basically tried to scare the jury.
Right.
You know, they talked about Osama. They talked about the coal bombings, talked about Africa. They put, like, a fear into the juries, and that's what happened to Uzair. See, what happened with Uzair is, one way you can tell that the government knows that Uzair didn't do anything is because they offered him a plea a month before.
Right. This was amazing. Why don't you describe what the plea offer? They offered him to plead guilty a month before this trial. And what was the
plea offer?
The plea
offer was 5 years. He's been inside already for almost 3 years. So he would have to done like maybe 15 months more with, you know, the federal timings and stuff.
Right.
So 15 months more, he would have been out.
Right.
They offered him a plea.
But he didn't take the plea. Why not?
He didn't take the plea because he said God told him not to take the plea.
Right.
And now what sentence does he face?
He can face up to 75 years.
So it's life.
It's life, yeah. You know,
How old is he now?
He's 25.
So it's amazing. The government was willing to give him only 15 more months if he had pled guilty, presumably, or possibly to something he never knew anything about, according to him. And
he wanted to clear his name.
He wanted to have a clear name. Yeah. And instead, he went to trial to clear his name, and now he's facing 75. Amazing case. You know, it's reminiscent, of course, of a lot of other cases like Lynn Stewart's and others, the attorney, where they bring in everything about terrorism and every terrorist act in the world, and the jury is sitting there. I mean, yeah. I guess.
And how long was the jury out before they decided?
5 hours.
That's all. Oh. Huh? Wow.
You know, that 5 hours.
Like Ahmed Omar Abu Ali.
They wanted to go home. You know, it was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. So basically, they just 5 hours, they convicted him. But the trial was it was biased because, you know, they don't talk about how Uzair was detained. He's been in solitary confinement since March of 2003. You know, he's held in a room the size of a closet, 24 wow. hours per day, mostly without heat. The light is on 24 hours a day.
Really? Wow.
His weight was 170 pounds before he was detained. Now he's 114 pounds.
No, really?
Yeah.
Amazing.
So he's lost almost 50 pounds. You know, we've constantly complained about his conditions. So, you know, what I think personally is that, you know, he's mentally, you know, he's very mentally disturbed. So
yeah,
that's
solitary will do that.
Yeah, and, you know, that's you know, why would you risk 75 years when you're getting 15 more months? You can get out in 15 more months. Why would you do that? It just doesn't make a sound decision. Right. You know, he knew that he wasn't going to get a fair trial.
Is he a U.S. citizen?
He's a green card holder.
So he was also going to be deported if he pled guilty, right?
Yeah.
Where would he have been deported to?
To Pakistan.
Uh-huh.
But that's fine. You know, his mother is in really, really bad shape. You know, she has a husband who's in Guantanamo.
Yeah.
He has a son who's detained here.
Right.
And you see all these pictures, the torture and, you know, everything that goes on in Guantanamo. And, you know, she reads all this stuff on the internet and it really, really affects her. She's on, you know, a lot of antidepressants. It's been very, very tough for the family.
What's the situation with your uncle in Guantanamo?
With my uncle, he's currently, from what I understand, he's being held in the worst camp in Guantanamo, Camp 5.
Camp 5 is really bad.
Yeah, he's being
described
held.
Describe that. Describe what you know.
You know, I don't know about, you know, from what I know is, you know, he's in total solitary confinement.
It's not that different from your cousin's situation.
It's not that different, but I guess in Guantanamo, you know, you hear a lot of really bad stories of how they torture people.
Well, that's right. I mean, the physical surroundings are essentially solitaire or an open sort of prison where the elements can come in, where they can strip you very easily, where they can leave a light on 24 hours. The guards pass by twice a minute, so every 30 seconds you have to go to the bathroom basically in front of everybody, the whole thing. I mean,
And the thing with him is, you know, he's 58 years old. You know, he's in very poor health. He has medical conditions. He has heart problems. He has diabetes. But the family's really concerned about his conditions. How can someone at this age who has these many medical conditions handle someone, you know, someplace like Guantanamo?
Now, he has lawyers now. I'm in the Center for Constitutional Rights. I know he's working with the lawyers that we've gotten.
G.T. Hunt, yeah. We have G.T. Hunt, but, you know, it's
as Hunt has visited him, right?
Hunt's visited him twice. Hunt has told us that when he was kidnapped in Bangkok, that basically, you know, they beat him, they stripped him naked, they didn't feed him for 3 days, and then they sent him to Bagram.
Wow. In Bagram, they do pretty bad.
Bagram was really bad. See, I have an interrogation report. The ACLU sued the U.S. government on these interrogation reports. This interrogation report accidentally left his name. The redactor accidentally left his name in there. And it talks about how he was treated extremely inhumanely, how he was, treated aggressively in a hostile manner. It refers to his health, how his health wasn't that good. He has shortness of breath. He was feeling very dizzy. You know, it's all in the report.
Is that what you have in front of you?
I have in front of me,
It's on the website as well.
You can go to the ACLU website. And this was a Freedom of Information Act case that was brought by ACLU, Physicians for Human Rights, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and others. And the ACLU has all the documents up on the site.
That's all the documents. I've mailed this to Pierre Prosper.
Prosper is?
He's handling detainee affairs, I guess, in the State Department.
Right.
And also Matthew Waxman, who's also in charge of detainee affairs, regarding, you know, this totally proves that my uncle was tortured. You hear George Bush, you hear the president, you hear all these people say that, you know, every investigation on torture will be thoroughly investigated. You know, they'll look into it. But I never got any response from them.
I'm sure not. I mean, these guys are bad guys.
Yeah. So, you know, this proves that he was tortured. A 58-year-old man, you know, how can you treat someone like that? It's not like, you know, they say that the biggest terrorists, the worst people are in Guantanamo. You know, my uncle's 58 years old. He has several he can't harm anybody. In Pakistan, you know, he set up hospitals in the poorest areas. He set up schools. He set up orphanages. He's been known for his charity work.
Wow. It's really an amazing story. Both stories are unbelievable.
How about you? How are you doing?
You know, it's been very tough for the family. You know, it's been really tough. We're just praying, you know, things get better. Everybody's given a fair trial. Like, you know, with Uzair, really hoped he would have taken the plea, but he didn't take the plea. He said God told him not to take the plea, and you know that's another big problem that we have to deal with now.
Yeah, boy, in the Southern District of New York, which is where he's tried, I mean, this is a very conviction-prone place. I mean, you don't have to have much evidence, if any, to get guys convicted.
Exactly. See, when you look outside the courtroom, the window in the courtroom, you see ground zero.
Amazing.
So it's, you know, how can you have a fair trial?
You know, well, the other thing it reminds me of course, with your uncle down there, it reminds me, but we've been talking about a bit, is the new legislation going through Congress right now, this Graham-Levin Amendment that's going to take away the right of the courts to hear the Guantanamo cases. And you're only going to have these appeals, and they may try and stop attorneys from going. They essentially want to put your uncle and others into a complete legal black hole. I mean, now at least whatever good we're doing, we at least get lawyers down there. We have some rights to go to court, some rights to do a challenge. And they're unfortunately, and Democrats supported this. It's a remarkable moment of stripping the courts from people like your uncle.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
If people want to help, what can they do?
No, they can come to our website. We set up a website, freeparachas.org.
Why don't you spell that?
Yeah, freeparachas.org, freeparachas.org. And, you know, please, you know, mail your senators, your congressmen about the case. You know, we're just asking for a fair trial. If people could please also write letters to the judge, Sidney Stein, for Azar's sentencing. He's facing 5 counts, 15 years each. He can get them concurrently or consecutively. If he gets them consecutively, he'll be facing 75 years. If he does them concurrently, he can do all 15 at once. So, you know, he's done three years already in extremely harsh conditions, in solitary confinement. So if people could please write to the judge, it's Sidney Stein in Southern District of New York, Federal Courthouse on Pearl Street, that would really help the family.
And this is a man, keep in mind, who has been convicted and is facing 75 years because he made a phone call inquiring about someone's immigration status as a favor. We'll put up the information on how exactly you can help on lawanddisorder.org. So I understand you got a picture of your uncle.
Yeah, basically what happened during his son's trial, they showed a picture of my uncle to the jury, to the courtroom and stuff, and it showed his face all bruised up. His beard is actually white, but his beard, the color was brownish-reddish, so you know it must be blood. He had no shirt on. His face is extremely red. You see all bruises all over his face. You see a busted lip. You know, this is when he was kidnapped in Bangkok.
And have you been visited by the FBI at all?
Yeah, I've been visited by the FBI. They interviewed me. You know, they asked me about my uncle and stuff, and I told them everything.
Right, which is only stuff that basically makes them what they are, which is apparently innocent of anything.
Yeah.
An amazing story of being a Muslim in America, I'll tell you. It's remarkable. One other thing, actually, I meant to mention. We were together at a press conference recently. It was a press conference on behalf of the witness against torture people from the Catholic Worker who went down to Guantanamo. So why don't you just mention what that was about a little bit, if you recall.
Basically, there's a group of protesters that went down to Guantanamo to protest. You know, I really appreciate what they're doing. You know, it's horrible for every American. Like, you know, people in Guantanamo would rather kill themselves than, you know, be tortured, humiliated, and detained illegally. It's a sad day for every American when, you know, a U.S. detention camp has detainees like this. You know, I have a quote here from one of the detainees. He writes, Samuel Lithi, an Egyptian detained in Guantanamo, says, "I'm in constant pain. I would prefer to be buried alive than continue to receive the treatment I receive. At least I would suffer less and die." You know, these are the type of quotes, these are the type of feelings people have in Guantanamo.
And this is our country in 2005, guys.
I just think people should get more involved. Like, you know, what's happening in Guantanamo is horrible, especially for a country like America, who's always, you know, throughout history, tried to support human rights. You know, you have Condoleezza Rice commenting on everybody else's problems and stuff. You know, you have to look at what's going on in America in this day and age.
And lying. And you have officials lying about what's happening in Guantanamo, what's happening in interrogation sites around the world. They're lying about the fact that they kidnap innocent people and put them in prison and torture them and essentially disappear them. The former CIA agent, Bear, he has that quote. He says, if you want to get someone interrogated, send them to Jordan. If you want them to be tortured, you send them to Syria. And if you want them to disappear, you send them to Egypt. And this is the business that our government is involved in. And the people that need to take responsibility for it to stop them are the people listening, the people not listening, the people in America, go to the website, freeparachas.org. We'll have a link to it up on lawanddisorder.org. Thank you, Tosi, for joining us on Law and Disorder.
This is going to take people's support to really get somewhere in these cases. Another but remarkable human outrage.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us.
Hi, this is Heidi Boghossian. I'm on the street in the East Village interviewing Eileen Clancy. A few days ago, the New York Times ran a front-page story uncovering covert police surveillance in New York City. Over the past 16 months, undercover police have infiltrated anti-war protests, bicycle protests, and even a street vigil for a bicyclist killed in an accident. The Times also ran several images taken directly from videotape documentation of seven public gatherings since August 2004, the time of the Republican National Convention. The videotapes were provided by Eileen Clancy, a forensic video analyst with Eyewitness Video. Eileen joins us today on Law and Disorder. Eileen, these videotapes clearly show undercover agents acting, often in a provocative fashion, designed to create a disturbance. When you were videotaping over the last couple of years, was this immediately apparent to you?
Well, I actually didn't anticipate that there were going to be the amount, the number of police undercover agents that we've seen now at so many of these public events. There are always, these days, many uniformed police officers and a certain number of people that you guess would call, I guess you would call plainclothes cops. But it was actually a couple of years ago, in 2003, was the first time I saw an event. It was an anti-war event, and there were four police officers dressed wearing stickers actually answer stickers, and carrying protest signs of various types, including one of them had a Free Mumia Abu Jamal sign. And I only noticed this because he went over to some uniform cops, and they were basically shaking hands and practically hugging. And I thought, what's going on here? And so that was in 2003. And I started to get the idea that there was something that was even a little different about what they were doing. They were actually trying to appear as protesters. And I think that's a problem.
Now, in the Times, one of the photos shows, for example, a person dressed as a protester with their hands behind their back, but there are no handcuffs being put on. So this undercover officer is going through the motions with his comrades. Did you start to see things like that as you sifted through your tapes?
The event you're describing is something that came up during the Republican convention in the summer of 2004. And I had never seen, until that time, the arrest of someone that was apparently what the Times called a sham arrest or a fake arrest. It's not clear why the police would try to arrest each other under some kind of pretense on the street. It really makes you think that there is some unhappy motive in that case. And with this particular guy, he's actually quite a large man. And it's been my experience at protest events that when the police in New York are arresting people, especially men of any size, that they tend to be pretty physically aggressive, even violent with them, because they don't want to get any resistance and they don't want to get hurt. So it was really unusual to see this guy arrested in this very calm fashion and walked off by three police officers, had his hands behind his back in an unnatural position, but there were no cuffs on. And fortunately, the photographer who took those pictures reached in, basically, and got an amazing picture. These are very hard pictures to get. And we know there's several instances that are reported in the New York Times story. We know that there are many, many other instances that we could not definitively say that these are police officers. But we know they're out there doing, you know, getting into some kind of shenanigans.
Now, one disturbing event was when police officers attended a bicycle vigil for a local bicyclist who had been killed. The Times reported that the police were actually videotaping. Were they undercover and acting as though they were just taking shots of what was going on?
Well, that's exactly right. What happened was there was essentially a vigil, a bicycle vigil for a young woman that was killed in New York on Houston Street and Avenue A. She was in her early 20s. She was actually run down by a garbage truck. There have been some of these events around the country where bicyclists try to bring attention to the unfortunately large number of deaths of bicyclists at the, you know, usually by vehicles on the street, motor vehicles. So they were doing this event, and many, many police officers showed up to it. Bicyclists were quite concerned. There was only about 15 bicyclists, so they decided they didn't want to take any chances. They didn't want to get arrested. They were just having this quiet event. And so they rode around town in single file in the bicycle lane and obeyed all the traffic laws. What happened was this particular woman was riding with them and carrying a video camera. She also participated in an event where they went down to the scene where the bicyclist had been killed, and there was a memorial event. So they were handing out flowers, and this female undercover police officer then videotaped this memorial event. To my mind, this is a really different situation than a situation where a lot of police officers simply turn up to an event, which is problematic in its own right. But actually having someone participating in this, wearing political slogans, really trying to pass herself off as a participant in a small event, mourning someone who's just been killed, I really think that is repugnant and excessive and just plain unnecessary. And I cannot imagine that there is any legitimate law enforcement purpose behind that. And I think that people need to think about, is this what we want our police department to be doing?
You raise an interesting question. We've talked on another segment today with Paul Chevigny about the Hanshu guidelines and the loosening of the restrictions that had been set in place. NYPD spokesperson Paul Brown didn't dispute that what the video showed, but as you know, maintained that the officers were there to maintain order and, as he says, to protect free speech. Where do we draw the line between having some officers lawfully attend and, as you say, then disguising themselves in intimate, smaller groups?
Well, with the expanded powers that the police have received from the federal judge under Hanshu, expanded powers that they now have to do surveillance on political events, First Amendment events, it's a big problem. It's really not clear. The lines of accountability are not clear on this. The police are not telling us. Are they allowed to do just about anything? Is this something that the police department commanders agree with, that these people are participating in events in this way? What the point of it is? We really don't know. It's a really gray area. Under the new guidelines, all of this activity is run under the intelligence department, the intelligence division of the police department, and they certainly are not talking about it. What's really helpful about the video is that we can at least have a more informed public discussion of these issues. It was very difficult to try to make any determinations about what the police were doing. It was very difficult to piece together these little snippets of video over months and months and months to try to figure out who were police officers, who might not be police officers, and if they'd done things that were inappropriate. Now that we have some basis for discussion, hopefully the public can weigh in on this in some fashion and let their thoughts be known about it.
The timing is certainly appropriate given what happened with the Bush administration's, the revelations about the domestic surveillance that's been going on. Eileen, are you at all concerned that you may be asked to turn over some of these videotapes to the police?
I haven't been asked to turn anything over yet, so we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, if we come to it.
And you're still pursuing your eyewitness videotapes of New York events as they come up?
Yeah, well, I'll be out videotaping and collecting videotape of all kinds of public events in New York City and elsewhere as we go along. I should say that, I mean, I don't know why the police would need to come to us for copies of the videotapes, because they're up on the New York Times website. The point of this is not to have sort of this secret archive. The point is really to try to tell the truth about what happened. And so we're trying to do that in a transparent way. And so we've allowed the New York Times to look at this material in a very holistic kind of a way. And then they've made decisions about what they think are significant there. And then we've put them out for the public to see. No one is expected to take all this on faith. They can take a look at it for themselves.
Eileen, you've performed definitely an important public service for all of us around the country. Is there information or a website on Eyewitness Video that people can go to?
Yeah, they can check Eyewitness Video. It's letter I, I-W-I-T-N-E-S-S, Eyewitness Video, that's one word, .info, I-N-F-O. Don't use the www, just eyewitnessvideo.info.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Eileen.
Thanks.
In late November, lawyers representing a long-running lawsuit governing New York City Police Department's surveillance of political activity filed a motion to enjoin an NYPD regulation. The NYPD is claiming that it can photograph and videotape all political activity in New York City without restriction, and that it may retain those photos and tapes for unlimited periods of time. The lawyers assert that this regulation violates the court's order and judgment in the long-running suit, Hanshu v. Special Services Division. Joining us on Law & Disorder is one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs in the class action, Paul Chevigny from NYU Law School. Welcome, Paul.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Can you give us a little overview of what was happening in the 70s when Hanshu first started?
Well, Hanshu was a class action brought by people who feared the surveillance of the police, Red Squad, as it was then called. We didn't know as much of the details about it then as we've learned in the intervening decades, but the idea was that the Red Squad was intruding in people's lives and was perhaps even provoking crimes. So on behalf of a group of activists, we brought a case to reform those practices. It was settled in the 1980s in a very complicated way, in which an administrative body was set up to approve every time the police would start an investigation for political reasons. It wasn't intended to control criminal investigations, but only political investigations. A couple of years ago, the police decided that they could no longer operate under the aegis of that administrative body, so they made a motion to amend it and replace it with some guidelines that, frankly, didn't make the plaintiff's lawyers very happy. They were quite weak. The judge approved them. But one of the provisions in them was restrictions on surveillance of political meetings, particularly photographic surveillance. And now the police claim that they can photograph any kind of an occasion, whether political or criminal. But much more important from our point of view, they claim that they can keep and catalog and make dossiers out of the photographs for as long as they choose, that there's no limit at all. And those two issues are the ones that we're making the motion about now.
What I understood from reading through some of the papers was that the NYPD policy on photos and videotape applied only if the police department needed to prepare training materials on crowd control techniques or if they had a reasonable belief that criminal activity might be afoot. Is that the old policy?
They claim that they can photograph any time because they might be doing it for training or they might be doing it for crime, and then they've gone on to say that there might be a civil claim, so they might want a record concerning what had gone on. We think that's debatable. We do think that in the case of a great many demonstrations, there really isn't any conceivable ground that fits into those categories. But even if there were, the biggest problem for us is that they're simply going to retain these records and catalog
and
them
collections
and make
of activists.
Mugshots out of them for as long as we live.
You know, Paul, it is something new because I remember in the 60s or 70s when these cases were brought, that law students at my law school refused to go out on demonstrations because they were afraid their photographs would be taken, put into the police mug book, and when they went through, you know, the Bar Association having trouble. And recently demonstrations, what you see is you see video cameras mounted on tops of cars. Yes. Taking everything. I mean, that's what's going on, right? I mean, they're taking everything. I mean, are they taking everybody who demonstrates?
Yeah.
Yes, and it seems that there was, a lull in the years before 2001 where the photographing of political activities was not so general because the not-so-strong provisions that existed for Hanshu in the old days were prevalent. So the police were limited in their investigations of overtly political activities.
You know, do you think they're actually setting up books again like they used to have of activists and things like that? Do we know that?
We don't know
we
that.
Don't know.
Well,
but,
you know, I was,
do I think? Yes. Do I know? No.
I was at a demonstration. I remember after 2001, I was at a demonstration, I think 2002, at the special registration facilities in downtown Manhattan. And across the street, someone who looked suspiciously like law enforcement with a very big camera snapping pictures, the huge zoom lens of all the demonstrators. That was a very different experience for me because I've been demonstrating, you know, I demonstrated all through college and through grad school and afterwards. And that was the first time that I had ever seen anyone snapping photographs like that of the demonstrators' faces.
Yeah, you know what's wrong with it, Dahlia. The democracy requires anonymity. You know, you shouldn't feel afraid to voice your point of view. You shouldn't feel like if you say something, right away you go into somebody's record book. You got the irony of this country saying it's going to bring democracy to Iraq, and they're out there in the streets with telephoto lens putting all of us in a record book.
We might talk a little bit about the ubiquity of picture-taking. Since the city isn't here, I might just say a word. The city's claim is we can go to a public meeting the same as anybody else can go to a public meeting. And then they say everybody takes pictures at public meetings. And we know that that is now true, that people constantly videotape and shoot stills at public meetings. And often, as we know from the Republican National Convention brouhaha, those photographs taken by the activists sometimes help a lot. But so the city's saying, well, we can take photographs just the way they can. Well, we think that's not true. But even if that were true, it's keeping the photographs on file and sharing them with other law enforcement agencies that mainly gives everybody the chills.
Now, why don't you think it's true to begin with? I mean, I agree with you. Like when they even say the FBI has a right to go to a religious service in a mosque just like any other Muslim does, why isn't that the case? Or why can't they go visit all the websites and check out all the names where Michael Ratner or Paul Chevalier appears? Or why can't they go to meetings? What is the argument you make? Legal or political or whatever, Paul?
Well, I could make a wonderful political argument, I think. But
we want to hear it.
But the legal argument about keeping the police out of public meetings is pretty weak, as you know, because historically the courts have refused to prevent law enforcement from attending public occasions. Now, it may be that there are grades. It seems to me that going to a religious congregation, which of course isn't closed, and they're almost always open, technically open to the public, but it seems to me it's a lot more intimidating for the consciousness of people at a mosque or a Baptist church or a synagogue or whatever to feel that somebody is creeping in and watching than it is at a rally in Union Square, even if the rally is political. So we need some kind of doctrine that separates different kinds of meetings, and we haven't got one. And the courts have really refused to control attendance of law enforcement officials at any kind of a public occasion, although they control eavesdropping and violations of the Fourth Amendment, but not surveillance in a public place.
Yeah, that's why I think what you're doing is focusing on what they do with it, because if you knew even when they took your picture at the demonstration that all they were going to do was do so-called crowd control and then get rid of it, then it would be less intimidating to people, I think.
Well, we think the guidelines have some controls that go beyond what the Constitution provides. In other words, that they were supposed to take photographs in connection with criminal matters if they wanted to, but there were some controls on political investigations, although they're very weak. But our chief concern is with respect to the keeping the records.
What happens next? When will the motion be heard in this case?
We've got it down for December 19th, but you know the way the legal system is. Anything can happen. They may want time to assemble their papers in response, or the judge may not be able to do it that day. So we don't know, but at the moment, that's the day.
And realistically, what do you expect to happen?
Oh, I think that the judge is going to be very sympathetic. Well, I shouldn't speak for the judge.
What judge you got?
It's Judge Haight. I would expect the judge to be sympathetic because, after all, we got beat on the previous go-round. These are the guidelines they wanted, man. So
it's just
they should have
to
comply
guidelines.
With them. If right. I were a judge and I had given everything to the defendants with respect to this.
Paul, you said before there are legal and political arguments against this kind of police state intrusion. What are the political arguments?
The political arguments are that the constant surveillance or even intermittent surveillance by law enforcement officials over political activities creates the famous chilling effect. Yeah. You need some sort of control over such intrusions. That's exactly what we had in the original Henshu guidelines. We had this little administrative outfit that had one civilian on it, a big deal. They weren't supposed to conduct surveillance of political activities at all without the approval for purposes of investigating a crime, without the approval of this Henshu authority. So that was a kind of control that we would envision as a control over government intrusion on political activities. But that has passed now since 2001. And what's the reason? Well, I was kind of incredulous at the time, but what I think it was actually about is exactly what Mike Ratner suggested, which is that I think they want to go sit in Muslim meetings and listen. I mean, I think their information about what terrorist activity might arise is probably vague enough and ill-focused enough so that they're almost starting from scratch and they're sitting in religious meetings and waiting for either someone to say something which seems inflammatory or for somebody to turn up whom the informant can befriend and then they can worm their way into the organization and find out stuff about terrorism.
That's so frustrating and aggravating that they come up with this. The Muslim population in the United States has absolutely nothing to do with terrorism and has nothing to do with terrorism. And if they want to investigate terrorism, they ought to go over to their buddies in Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 of the terrorists were from Saudi Arabia. They ought to start talking to people over there. And to use this as a pretext to suppress political liberties here in New York City is just absolutely outrageous.
Okay.
Good.
So, Paul, you've been in on this case for the long haul. It's been a couple of decades plus.
Uh-huh.
Are the original attorneys still
The original attorneys are still on the case, all the people who first worked on it. Many of the plaintiffs who first worked on it don't seem to be around. But it's been wonderful for the lawyers. It's kept us together as a group of friends. We hang out together. We have dinners together. We have conferences about this case. I wouldn't say that we go so far as to hope that the defendants will violate the guidelines once again so that we can get together and have a party, but it comes close to that. So we're sorry that they've done it, but as friends, we are pleased that we're able to get together and give them a fight.
Yes, and these guys have been at it for how many years now, Paul?
34.
34 years. So we're going to have to train another generation after you guys.
Yeah, I was the old man on the case at that point, and now I'm the very old man.
Hey, you're looking good. And,
Paul,
you know, keep fighting. Thank you, Paul Chevigny.
Thank you.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.